It's Thursday, January 19th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Front page, New York Times. It wasn't the real front page. It wouldn't sound like that. Panel rejects Hochul's pick for top judge. This is a judge named LaSalle, the progressives in the chamber. A judge adjudicate him to be too moderate. You know, I'm sure they'd say something other than moderate. They'd say extreme or something. Anyway, here's the relevant line. The rejection does not necessarily mean that the LaSalle saga is over. The governor has not ruled out taking legal action to force a vote on Justice LaSalle's nomination on the full Senate floor, raising the specter of a constitutional showdown. Also, front page, inches away, Israeli justices order Netanyahu to fire minister. A minister in Benjamin Netanyahu's new right-wing coalition, a move likely to accelerate a looming showdown. And of all the showdowns that loom, this one looms boldly.
If Republicans decide not to lift the ceiling, it will undoubtedly start a fiscal showdown that's going to have big consequences for the American people.
That was Ali Velshi of MSNBC talking about the debt ceiling showdown. And showdown is how it's often described. CNN, every American could feel the pain of Washington's next showdown. Bloomberg, debt ceiling showdown. Trump wants Republicans to play chicken with economy. So why so many showdowns? And is this one really a showdown? I have answers. One, the idea of regular events or conflicts, hyped or inflated, to be considered showdowns. Well, that is aligned with the incentives towards drama of the media. However, showdowns are news, right? Compelling drama, i.e. the show part of a showdown, that is one of the definitions, one of the criteria of news. And three, the idea of a showdown may be hyped not just by outsiders, but by the participants themselves. The recent nursing strike in New York, maybe you heard about it, got some national attention, not sure it should have. It was a couple day strike. They settled it. I guess it had the potential to cause real problems. It didn't. But all the participants were incentivized to press their case, but they were not incentivized to pay a cost. I've covered a lot of contract negotiations, often in sports, and they often go down to the last minute, what's also called the 11th hour, two phrases that seem to be in conflict with each other. And what usually happens is the fans or even people on sports talk radio bemoan, oh, why can't these millionaires and billionaires just settle it before now? I can't believe it got to this point. I could believe it. I could always believe it, because just like the nurses or NBA players, taking it to the wire shows that you're not giving up concessions, allows for the possibility that you'll get the most you can. If you settle too soon, you may settle for less than you would have gotten anyway. If you just don't settle before you have to settle. The political showdowns that we're talking about, in some cases, are simply cases of non-capitulation. Hochul will have to decide how far to press her case for her judge, but if she does so and presses it pretty far, we could say showdown and get a little upset that there's a showdown and maybe convince ourselves there's something like dysfunction in government. But it could also be seen, and I think this is right, as just exhausting all remedies and options to achieve a policy objective. The debt ceiling is not yet a showdown. It could become one. But both sides are incentivized to call it a showdown. And all sides, including the media that wants attention, are incentivized to call it a showdown. By the way, not only do I not blame the media for wanting attention, this thing should get attention, and I am the media giving it attention, thus proving my point. Republicans like the idea of a showdown because without the threat of catastrophe, they won't get anything, and they at least like to signal that they're trying to get something, and maybe some of them think that they will get something. Democrats think, I agree with this, that it's a showdown, or like the idea of portraying it as a showdown, because that paints the Republicans as reckless and unreasonable. I guess the Republicans could turn out to be reasonable or reasonable enough to take some sort of deal before damage starts rippling through the economy. And until then, and until the debt markets really start reacting like this could really happen, it's not much of a showdown. It's posturing and threatening the playing of chicken, which you also heard in that headline. But I don't think you start playing chicken until you're right at the moment of swerve or die. You don't start playing chicken when you say, I'm going to play chicken, when you get in the car, when you put the key in the ignition, when you're 200 yards away, when you're 100 yards away, when you're even 50 yards away, within the fast twitch muscle reaction time. It has to be right at the point of no return. And then it is a proper showdown, which in the case of the debt ceiling would be an extremely improper showdown. And we'll know it's a showdown in retrospect, or there's a small possibility that there won't be an opportunity for much retrospect because we'll all be too busy picking up the pieces of the wreckage to say, hey, let's conduct a post hoc assessment. I don't think the wreckage will occur, but I will let you know when the bond market and short-term debt markets let me know. On the show today, the Rust shooting and my surprise at the manslaughter charges against Alec Baldwin. But first, demographic changes in the United States have been used to explain everything from our politics to our funeral rituals. And that's accurate. And there are some hidden shifts that we see, and they get explained as, oh, it's a great awakening. Oh, it's people getting more moral. It's people getting more informed. But a lot of the time, it's just the old people who had the old way of thinking. They're just dying. Philip Bump is here to talk about all of this and his new book, The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. The book has lots of charts. It will be my job to bring them to life in sonic form. Philip Bump up next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. When they say demographics is destiny, it usually means, well, that's a clever phrase with two D's in it. But what they usually mean is something like the change that you think might only come from a bullet might actually come from birth rates, which is, as far as it goes, an interesting observation, but maybe not one that's earth-shaking. What Philip Bump has done in his new book about demographics is to flesh out the change that we know is upon us, but we don't really realize all the contours of. It is the change of the baby boom shuffling off this mortal coil. The name of the book is The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. Power is really important because he writes a lot about politics. He writes a lot about not just consumer trends, but where we're going as a nation, what our values will be. And he does it all with graphs, quite crucially. Philip Bump, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So first of all, I think you like me. I mean, I see this reflected in the book. We have a general skepticism of the entire notion of the generation, of the distinct set of people who share so much in common just because they have a particular set of birth years. Right. But it's a pretty recent phenomenon. How much does it illuminate? How much does it obscure thinking about generations as distinct sets?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to think about generations. The first is in the actual technical structural sense. And so if we look at a generation as a demographically distinct group of people, there's only one generation that the Census Bureau, which I would defer to on such things, actually recognizes as a generation. That's the baby boom. There are markers, demographic markers of the baby boom. And in the book, if you look at the graphs in the book, you can see I show the birth rate per year over the course of the middle of the 20th century. And you can see this giant spike in births in 1946 that starts to taper by the early 1960s. That is a demographically distinct group of people that has been assigned the title of generation by the Census Bureau. Everything else is marketing. Millennials is marketing, Gen X is marketing, Gen Z is marketing, the names are made up. Like, there's nothing about them that constitutes an actual defined group of people. Beyond that, it is useful broadly for marketers, but also broadly for Americans, to be able to point to people of particular age groups and refer to them collectively. Now, of course, this gets blurry when we get into, like, you know, what happens in 1980? Am I Gen X or am I millennial? Like, you know, when you get to the sort of nebulous areas in the middle, It can get a little vague, but we know generally what a Gen Xer is. We know what a millennial is. We know what a Gen Zer is. And that's actually sort of useful in our public conversations. And that's sort of why we adopt them.
We do kind of know what they are, but hilariously to me, the silent generation gets it a lot more wrong than it gets it right. And you can understand that because, as you just said, the entire notion of a generation postdated their existence.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. So yeah, the silent generation, which is the generation, I mean, it's, and again, this is the point. It sort of depends on which definition you use, right? So the silent generation could be the parents of the greatest generation, which are the people that served in World War II and then birthed the baby boom, except, of course, also baby boomers are birthing baby boomers because it lasted 20 years. Like, this is the point. Like, it's all very vague. It's all very contrived. It is useful, but it's also important to realize it's useful in part now in modern society because we are much more attuned to issues like polling and marketing research and all these various things that they didn't worry about as much in 1930. But now it's useful for us in a broad range of fields to be able to pinpoint these particular age cohorts.
So other than the fact that they're all going to be dying pretty soon, what's the biggest change that the shuffling off the mortal coil, that the death of the baby boomers are going to be foisting upon us?
Right. So, yeah, one of the things that's interesting is a lot of them aren't going to be dying that soon, right? So the baby boom, 1946 to 1964. So 1964, we're talking about a group of people that isn't even yet 60 years old, right? So, you know, the baby boom is going to be around for a couple of other decades. The issue and the reason I thought it was useful to write the book in this moment is less that the boom is all dying off, but that their power is dying off, right? That they are losing political power. They're losing economic power. They've already lost cultural power. And that because the boom was so big, such a massive force in American society for so long and really dominant and, you know, attracted money and attracted attention and all these various things. And now they're seeing that go away for the first time since they've existed, right? And that's what makes this moment, I think, particularly tense. Your question is what happens next, which of course is, you know, 200 pages of the book. I don't want to spoil all of it by reading it, you know, verbatim here. But I think we can anticipate a few things. The first is that there's going to be a massive shift of wealth, although it's not clear exactly how much wealth is going to be shifted. Right now, there's a group called Cerulli Associates. They estimate that in 2022, about $2 trillion a year was being transferred from members of the baby boom generation, either to members of their family or to organizations, you know, contributions, charitable contributions, things along those lines. $2 trillion a year. And that's only going to accelerate as boomers get older. But of course, it also depends on how long they live and medical costs and things along those lines. So there's some uncertainty there, but we can anticipate that that's going to happen. Politically is a huge question mark, right? We know that the baby boomers, and especially older than baby boom, silent generation, greatest generation, are much more conservative than younger Americans. What does that mean? People assume that as you get older, you tend to get more conservative. They're actually, you know, going back to my point about how there isn't, there aren't centuries worth of social science that can inform this. It's not really clear if that's a real pattern or just sort of the way that we talk about politics. But will younger Americans become more conservative as they age? Is that going to change what politics looks like? But of course, that then is informed by the fact a central divide here, and a central distinction is that the baby boom is much more heavily white than our younger generations. And so it's not just that the younger generations are young and therefore more liberal. It's also that they're far less white than our older generations. And, you know, African-Americans and Hispanics and Asian-Americans tend to vote more heavily Democratic. So there are all these factors. And, you know, the short answer to your question is, I guess we'll see. And it depends a lot on what's happening in the moment. But the long answer, obviously, is the book itself.
Yeah, in fact, it's the other stuff, it's the power stuff that captivated me most. I'm fascinated by questions of wealth. I'm fascinated by questions of race. And I think that we so often get it wrong. One of the ways is that we've overstated, I've talked about this on my show a lot, we've overstated how quickly America is becoming what we call a majority-minority country.
Yeah, right.
And much of that definition, you make this point, is that if we continue to define Hispanics as being not white, maybe that'll be true, but that's just not how the human beings in our society are operating.
Yeah, and this is a really, really key point. So there's a lot of reaction in the American political sphere to this idea that white Americans are declining as a cultural force, right? Again, this overlaps with the baby boom itself, which is one of the central theses of the book. But it's also something that is dependent upon a very rigid set of definitions in two ways. First is, as you point out, the idea that Hispanic Americans will continue to identify Hispanic over the course of multiple generations simply doesn't hold up. We see lots of research that shows that actually over time, Hispanic Americans are more likely to identify as white or something other than Hispanic as generations progress. The other way is that the Census Bureau has already taken steps to better capture the ways in which Americans already identify as more racially complicated than the forms would suggest. And so, you know, I look at this as sort of a Schrodinger's cat sort of situation, right? Erwin Schrodinger's cat, you don't know if it's alive or dead until you open the box to see, right? It's the same way with race for a lot of people. You don't really identify what your race is until you're presented with a government form and says, what is your race? And you're like, okay, well, what the hell am I? You know, right? You know, for a lot of us, it's, yeah, I'm a white guy. Like, I just write white and I'm not Hispanic. But there are other people, you know, my wife, for example, she is Hispanic, Native American, and half white. So what she identifies as is sort of dependent. Like, well, you know, what is the cultural force that's most dominant for her in that day, right? You know, is she white? Is she Hispanic? These are decisions that I don't have to make. But for a lot of Americans, they were forced to choose between white, black, Asian. And then, you know, as a separate question, their ethnicity, are they Hispanic or not? So now what the Census Bureau did, particularly in the 2020 census, is they made it so you could basically just write down, here's my entire background. So, you know, I have some French and, you know, I also have some Dominican and I have from Africa, whatever it happens to be. Because basically they just let people say, hey, are you white or are you sort of white and a bunch of other things? And a lot of people said, well, yeah, that's me. And so to some extent then, when we're considering what America looks like, we're already, you know, we have already reached this point where there's so many people who are white, who really are identify when you ask them and impress them on it. Well, actually, I'm a whole lot of different things.
Right.
And so the idea that we're all of a sudden going to pass this 50% mark and now we are no longer half white. We either are already there or it's going to happen way further in the future or it's going to happen exactly the moment they say. And it's really hard to say because it's all dependent on how people identify themselves in the moment.
Yeah, and it seems to me that as we are getting a more accurate definition, that's what the Census Bureau is giving us, or at least a less inaccurate definition, an acknowledgement right. That there are a lot of complications to all of this. You can't have a problem with a less inaccurate definition. That's always good. More knowledge in the world. The problem comes in when you had a rigid and, dare I say, inaccurate definition of what whiteness meant in terms of politics. So if you were locked right. into the idea that, well, whites vote Republicans and then say, oh, look, we're getting less white, therefore we're getting less Republican. The mistake you made
right.
isn't the one about we're getting less white. It's will it always mean that whites are going to vote Republican?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so one of the things that has accompanied this increased complexity in our understanding of what race looks like is an increased complexity in how that overlaps with politics. You're absolutely right. And so we see all these ways in which the differentiations of whiteness reflect different political views, right? So you have, for example, you know, we have this huge debate that emerged during the coronavirus, as the coronavirus vaccines were being distributed, over, you know, are Black Americans less likely to get the vaccine than our white Americans. And then what happens is if you actually split that up into white Democrats and white Republicans, it's actually white Republicans who are the ones that are not getting it because, you know, there is this divide, just partisan divide within the white community as well. But of course, that divide also manifests in every other racial group. And there's this huge fight after 2020 about, you know, the extent to which Hispanics and Black Americans are potentially starting to vote more heavily Republican, in part because there's a breakdown of social institutions and for Hispanics in particular along the Texas border and in South Florida, there's this sense of their being different as a Hispanic group than new immigrants, for example, who are a group that the Democrats have long targeted. So it really is this increased understanding broadly of how Americans identify themselves and identify their politics. You know, one of the things this overlaps with, and I'm not saying these are causal. I'm not saying that, you know, because people are now having a more sophisticated, nuanced sense of who they are racially, that they're also doing that politically. But, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that we have these more nuanced understandings of our own personal identities. And it's happening at the same time that we see people more likely to identify as independent instead of Democrat or Republican, right? I think that it's just sort of this moment in which there is this movement away from rigidity that I think the Census Bureau is starting to catch up to and which has this overlap with politics as well.
Give me a talk about another thing where I saw a lot of hype, which is how important the youth vote was in the midterm elections.
Yeah.
I watched panels where they talked about and they had, you know, a young campaigner on. We couldn't have done it without you. And I was looking at the exit poll saying the Democrats got 1% less of a vote of voters under whatever your age threshold was, 30. But what are you at least charter of demographics seeing as far as that goes?
Yeah, no, that's overblown. I've written about that for the Post. I don't think there's the data to suggest that. All of the data I have seen about what the youth vote did in 2022 comes from organizations that are predicated on organizing the youth vote. And all the data I've seen from them is sort of amplifying a particular argument that I'm not sure actually bears scrutiny.
Yeah.
But here's an interesting thing to consider, right? I mentioned earlier, 2008, the election of Barack Obama was this moment in which the youth and older vote really started to separate. Well, that was 14 years ago, right? And so the people who were 20 then are now in their mid-30s. The people who were, 30 then are now in their mid-40s. We have seen that youth vote get older and move into an age group in which they're voting more heavily. We saw the difference between 2016 and 2020. The same percentage of the electorate was baby boomer, but about half of the size of the older generation in 2016 came out to vote in 2020 because that group was dying off. And that's a group that very heavily voted for Trump. And so there is, at the same time that we have these younger voters who are very heavily Democratic entering the electorate, they tend to vote much less heavily. We also see that much older and much more conservative voters are leaving the electorate. Yet at the same time, we are seeing that we still have a lot of elections in which Democrats and Republicans run fairly even as those Obama voters from 2008 have gotten older. And so the takeaway on that for me is elections are complicated and different things happen in different years, which is, again, sounds like a cop-out. But, the 2020 election was not about the age of the people participating as much as it was a lot of people didn't like Donald Trump and wanted to get him out of office. 2022, I think, was very much about the Democrats had a surprisingly resonant message about the Republicans and the threat to democracy that I don't think anyone anticipated would be as strong as it was. And then, of course, you layer abortion on top of that. So it is hard for me to be able to say the impact of generations over the short term, over the short election cycle, simply because the elections are, they're their own entities and they are driven by their own forces in the moment. So I am loath as a result to sort of say, hey, I don't think it was any of these generational changes, although it doesn't seem to have been.
What, if anything, has surprised you about the persistence of really far right or just unhinged from reality, Republicanism, the ability of that to continue to not just persist, but somewhat thrive in American politics?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this comes down, I think a lot of this comes down to a competing media universe framework. And obviously, I am somewhat biased in the sense that I work for a particular component of one of those media universes. But I really do think that, I was just watching a clip earlier today in which this guy who was, one of these QAnon, let's go fight the pedophiles thing, was talking about how the emergence of social media really empowered this very fringe right worldview to, operate and coalesce around these ideas. The example of the power of the internet I always like to use is that, back in the 1990s, there were people who liked to dress up as animals for sexual pleasure and no one knew about it, And then all of a sudden you get the internet and all of a sudden you have furry conventions, right?
Right.
The power of the internet to organize is really, really striking.
That's so exactly the group Zuckerberg had in mind when he talked about bringing people together.
Yeah, it's quite possible. Furry motivated, it's quite possible. Yeah. But in the same way that you can organize furries enough to have conventions in Pittsburgh, you can also organize, QAnon activists to think that they're fighting, Tom Hanks is pedophilia. And so you have this entire universe of people that is both self-reinforcing. They're telling each other they're right. They're sharing this, quote unquote evidence with each other. And they have real people like Donald Trump tapping into it and saying, hey, you know what? You're right. You guys are the right actors. And I think that entire sphere, of which, of course, Fox News overlaps pretty substantially and some actual other mainstream outlets do. But you have this entire universe of people who are telling themselves these things and just simply impervious. I can hand them. I can say, look, this is out from behind the paywall. This is me. I have done the assessment. I have talked to people. And I did this like on 2000 Mules, Dinesh D'Souza's movie about voter fraud. Like the guy in the movie, this guy, Greg Phillips in Truth the Vote, he admitted that he'd made up these maps. And I can print this out and say, look, he talked to me and he made this up. And they just don't believe it. And there's nothing you can do about that. And I think that's a central part of it.
Yeah, but that against, and you know this, I'm not going to say something you don't agree with, but that against every chart in this book, which represents 100 million people birthing and dying and changing, it doesn't seem like even the most captivating algorithm stands up against the life-death cycle of a society.
Yeah, okay. So this is a different question, right? And this is sort of the heart of the book, which is that, yes, I think that despite the fact that we see a lot of younger Americans who ascribe to this the power that comes from adhering to these views, I think that, yeah, we are going to see this generational shift, you know, sort of broadly speaking in terms of the way that people approach things. And, you know, people with whom I spoke point to the civil rights era and point to the South. And so in the civil rights era South, there were a lot of older people who were still Democrats, even though they disagreed with what the Democratic Party had done with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and things along those lines. And what happened is they got old and died, and they were replaced by younger people who had the exact same views as they did, but registered differently, right? And so the transition that we saw politically happened, you know, 20, 30 year lag time in the South, in part because the people who were there had just always been Democrats, and that's what they were. And so you actually saw the generational shift there, having the central leading to the political change in the American South. And there are some other places in the country where, you know, we might look for similar shifts as generations pass on. But I do think that we are, you know, I am optimistic enough about America to think that, you know, as this group of people who tends to be older, who tends to be less sophisticated in their understanding of media, that as these people leave the conversation, that things will improve, despite this group of people that is now currently empowered, you know, the Charlie Kirks of the world, who are empowered to echo these sentiments just for their own benefit. I am optimistic about that actually occurring.
Yes, but with the South, it was clear what those post-civil rights whites who still identified as Democrats, it was clear what their worldview was and how they would vote on issues. Little less clear about the demographic changes we're seeing in America at the moment.
Yeah, that's true. Although I would say that, yes, if you presented those Southern Democrats with the civil rights bill, they're going to vote no. But if you presented them with other Democratic legislation, they would vote with the rest of the caucus. And that there was a complexity to the Democratic Party, which has been lost over time, because you don't, you know, and I'm not saying it was beneficial. It was good to have members of the Democratic Party who are segregationists. But there was a change in how the party had to operate as sort of a collective force once that shift occurred. And then once that shift occurred, you know, those people became Republicans, and they voted much more heavily Republican than across party lines. That's what I'd say to that.
Philip Bump is a national columnist for The Washington Post. He is the author of The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom, and The Future of Power in America. I was hoping somehow we'd get to the furries, and we did. Thank you, Phil.
Of course.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way, or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Actor Alec Baldwin was charged with two counts of involuntary manslaughter for the 2021 fatal shooting on the New Mexico set of the film Rust. Armorer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed faces the same charges in the death of cinematographer Hala Hutchins. A jury will decide, if it gets that far, which of two types of involuntary manslaughter apply. Each has a penalty of up to 18 months in jail, but one includes a firearm enhancement or a mandatory penalty that's punishable by a mandatory 5 years in jail. I'm surprised that Baldwin, a guest on this program 2 weeks ago, though not with me as the host, was charged. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised. I'll take you through my thinking, what the law says, and what the district attorney in this case literally said in public filings. So there actually are two prosecutors on this case. One is New Mexico's first judicial district attorney. First is a reference to the area that includes Santa Fe, near where the shooting occurred. Mary Carmack Altweiss, a Democrat, is described on her official website as living in Santa Fe with her wife, Jo, a retired law enforcement officer, and their two energetic young children. The other attorney appointed special counsel is Andrea Reeb, who was an experienced prosecutor and who, after her appointment as special prosecutor, was elected to the New Mexico legislature as a Republican, favoring a law and order agenda. Carmack Altweiss argues in a public statement that the evidence clearly shows a pattern of criminal disregard for safety on the Rust film set. In New Mexico, she says, there is no room for film sets that don't take our state's commitment to gun safety and public safety seriously. There certainly seemed to be a disregard for gun safety. Gun safety literally was the job of the armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, 24 years old, on one of her first ever assignments. She was reprimanded by the producers for leaving guns unattended on the set. The film's director, Joel Souza, who was wounded in the shooting, told investigators afterward that Gutierrez-Reed stood over him, quote, hysterically yelling, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." She also seemed to incriminate herself when talking to investigators, bleeped tape of which is available.
These things happen with
these
somebody.
I know, I can't believe I'm like the last thing like this to happen since The Crow.
And it's my own worst nightmare.
I'm my worst freaking nightmare, she said, after referencing The Crow, another film that featured a shooting death on set. Gutierrez-Reed also told investigators that although she checked Baldwin's gun that day before the shooting, she, quote, didn't really check it too much after lunch, trusting that the weapon was locked away in a safe. So the person in charge and responsible for gun safety was irresponsible. The culpability ends there, right? Well, no. And here's where I got things wrong. In October, when Baldwin settled a suit with Hutchins' family, the prosecutor, Carmack Altweiss, issued a statement that said, in part, no one is above the law. Yesterday, in her statement, she reiterated, on my watch, no one is above the law, and everyone deserves justice. The LA Times, a few months ago, quoted as an expert, an attorney, Miguel Custodio, who said, it really seems like the state of New Mexico, which has seen increasing movie productions in the state, I think they really want to send a strong signal out to not only this current project and producers, but to future movie production sets that intend on filming in New Mexico, that it's okay to be a low-budget movie and to cut some corners, but safety is not a corner that should ever be cut. And I think they are going to most likely charge Baldwin. He was right. I was wrong. Alec Baldwin was also wrong, is what he told George Stephanopoulos in an interview in early December.
I've been told by people who are in the know in terms of even inside the state that it's highly unlikely I would be charged with anything criminally.
And I think the reason he was wrong, certainly the reason I was wrong, is that I defer to industry tradition and the norms, long-established norms, of handling guns and firearms in movies. But the law doesn't care about norms. There is no carve-out in the law for the way it's always been done or what has largely worked until now. Basically, aim a gun and fire it, and you face liability if it goes off and hurts someone. Now, the implications do seem that every actor who's ever been on stage or in a movie, who's ever pointed a gun at a fellow cast member, or in this case, a worker on the movie, as part of a role, and trusted a prop master, did not know it at the time, but that actor faced prison if somehow the gun went off. If it's shown that in his role as producer of the film, Baldwin fostered an unsafe atmosphere, which does not seem to be the emphasis of prosecution, my calculation would change. But for now, we seem to have a discrepancy in longstanding practice and legal liability, And in those cases, the law has final say. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara is producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson is senior producer. Michelle Pasca is COO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Peru, G Peru, Do Peru. Thanks for listening.